From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As we near the end of the year, on today's Fresh Air, we talk with someone who's made a career of looking toward the future, science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. Also today, I talk with newspaper obituary writer Jim Nicholson. Instead of writing the death notices of movers and shakers, he celebrates the lives of the working class. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Momentum, the new album from soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. And television critic David Bianculli previews the TV adaptation of Harold Pinter's one-act play, The Room. It stars Linda Hunt and Donald Pleasence, and it's directed by Robert Altman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. When he started writing science fiction in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. Asimov's books like I, Robot and the Foundation Trilogy have made him one of America's most influential science fiction writers. This year, he was honored with a Nebula Award that named him Grand Master of Science Fiction. He's also one of our most prolific writers with 366 books under his belt. Many of those books explain scientific phenomena and offer his projections about life in the future. Asimov's latest book is Fantastic Voyage 2, a follow-up to the novelization he wrote of the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage. Isaac Asimov emigrated with his parents to America from the Soviet Union in 1923 when he was 3 years old. They settled in Brooklyn, New York. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. We started off with his childhood. These are the science fiction magazines that first hooked him on the genre.
The very first one was Amazing Stories in 1929. I then passed on to Science Wonder Stories and Air Wonder Stories. And finally, in 1930, when a new magazine came out called Astounding Stories, I read that. In short, I read all the science fiction magazines there were.
How did you discover them?
My father had a candy store, and I discovered them on his newsstand. He wouldn't let me read the magazines, but I convinced him that science fiction dealt with science. And he let me read that, which is a good thing.
It's funny that he should be selling them but not allowing his son to read them.
Oh, that was not at all funny. I presented him with that paradox myself. And he said, well, he was not responsible for other people, but he was responsible for the welfare of his son.
Were your parents determined that you should be a doctor or a lawyer?
My father wanted me to be a doctor, and I didn't want to be, but being a obedient son, I applied to medical school, and to my great relief, I was rejected. So I went on for chemistry.
I guess the chemistry helped more in your science fiction writing and science writing than the medical degree would have.
Well, it's not that so much. It's just that medical school would have taken up all my time and I wouldn't have been able to write. So that it was would not have been a good idea for me to go to medical school, aside from the fact I would have hated being a doctor.
You had your first story published in 1938 in Astounding Science Fiction, which was one of the magazines that you mentioned you used to read. John Campbell was the editor then, and he was one of the most influential science fiction editors. And you worked with him for many years. What was the early advice that he gave you about your writing?
Well, I'm not sure that he gave me general advice. He would point out where I had gone wrong in specific stories. And what he told me afterwards was that he had high hopes for me because I listened to what he said and apparently took advantage and learned from what he said. Incidentally, he published my third story. My first two stories were published in Amazing Stories. They were Campbell rejects.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What was your very first story that you published?
Marooned Off Vesta. And I sold it on October 21st, 1938, and it appeared in the stands in the March 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, which hit the stands on January 9th, 1939, 1 week after my 19th birthday. So that next year I'll be celebrating my golden anniversary as a professional writer.
Were your parents impressed when you actually got into print?
Yes, they were. My father especially. He would send letters to all his friends And fortunately, he stopped after three or four had appeared.
So it would have taken a lot of letters if he wrote every time you got published.
Yes.
So what was that first story about?
It was a ship that had gone through the asteroid belt and was hit by an asteroid. And there was just a piece of it left with three men on board, and they had to get themselves down to the asteroid Vesta, which was nearby. And I made it sound as exciting as I could possibly manage. And they bought it. They paid me $64 for it.
Now, what did you base those early stories on? On actual science knowledge that you had or on other science fiction stories that you read?
Mostly on other science fiction stories. Although they got me interested in science, and I gradually learned science as a result. But science fiction was an even earlier influence.
The more you learned about science, were you able to get further away from using other science fiction as source material?
Well, I was, you know, you use other science fiction as source material from the standpoint of atmosphere and just how to write. But the science itself gave me the raw material for the plots.
What were those early science fiction magazines like? What did they look like? What kind of illustrations did they have? What was the feel of it?
Those early magazines were larger than the magazines, the science fiction magazines of nowadays. Some were actually the size of the Slicks, the Sat Evening Post, things like that. Usually they're made of cheap paper with rough edges. They paid a half cent a word to a cent a word. And the only way you could possibly make a living out of this pulp fiction was to write a great deal and quickly and without undue revision. And I learned how to do that in those days. I thought that was the way to write. I didn't know any better. And I've kept that up ever since. And so as a result, I now have published 366 books, and I'm making a good living out of it.
Well, seriously, do you think that getting paid by the word taught you to be wordy?
No, but it certainly taught me to work hard and long because they didn't pay much by the word, so that you couldn't spend much time in polishing and in producing beautifully crafted prose. That way you starve to death. And so I learned to write quickly and under all circumstances. I couldn't wait for inspiration to hit. I couldn't wait until I had, say, 5 straight hours of peace and quiet. I had to write whenever I had 15 minutes that I could squeeze in.
How old were you when you started to be able to support yourself from your writing?
Well, it depends on what you mean by support yourself. I was able to put myself through school, through college and graduate school, on my earnings. And I was able to supplement my income during the years when I worked as a professor at Boston University School of Medicine. I still keep the title, by the way. But it wasn't until I was in my late 30s that I could look forward to actually making a good living on writing alone. So I was not an overnight success.
Science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov is my guest, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2. It's a sequel to The Fantastic Voyage. Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was the In fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language. And I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
That must be a thrill.
Yeah. Two other words also I get the credit for.
Oh, really? Which ones?
One is psychohistory, which I was the first to use in my Foundation series. And the other is positronic, which I was the first to use in connection with my robots.
No, wait, what's positronic?
Well, it's the same as electronic, except instead of electrons, you use the opposite sort of particles called positrons. They were only discovered in 1934, and 5 years later I began to speak of positronic brains instead of electronic ones. And I happened to be the first one to do that. But it's a logical word. All three words are logical words, you see. If I hadn't used them, someone else would have, but I did.
Well, before we get to psychohistory, let's go back to robotics. Well, tell us how you came up with the word.
Well, I thought that was the word. You know, what's the science dealing with the study of robots, the maintenance of robots, the design of robots? Almost all the branches of physics end in ICS, physics itself, hydraulics, celestial mechanics, statics, electrodynamics. The ICS is the usual physics ending, so I figured that if you're going to deal with robots, the science is robotics.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that were used in science fiction. They were made of metal and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared. And the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, maybe we're returning to the old kind of robots again. I'm thinking of the movie RoboCop, in which the robot finally does destroy its creator.
Well, you have to understand that, in general, the movies are some 50 years behind printed science fiction, so that the level of the movies we get is roughly the level of science fiction, real science fiction of the 1930s.
Let's move on to another word that you coined, and that is psychohistory. And that was in your Foundation trilogy. And it's really the science of group behavior reduced to mathematical equations.
Yes, exactly. Of course, Erik Erikson, who's a psychiatrist, invented the word psychohistory as a way of determining historical changes as affected by the psychiatric qualities of important men like Woodrow Wilson or Albert Einstein or Sigmund Freud or Adolf Hitler. And that use of the word psychohistory is more common than my use, but it was invented later.
What did you have in mind when you coined the term and the concept?
Well, I wanted to write a short story about the fall of the Galactic Empire. I just finished reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire the second time, and I thought I might as well adapt it to on a much larger scale to the Galactic Empire and get a story out of it. And my editor, John Campbell, was much taken with the idea and said he didn't want it wasted on a short story. He wanted it an open-ended series that would last forever, perhaps. And so I started doing that. In order to keep the series going from story to story, I was essentially writing future history. And I had to make it sufficiently different from modern history to give it that science fictional touch. And so I assumed that the time would come when there would be a science in which things could be predicted on a probabilistic or statistical basis.
Do you think that would be good if there really was such a science?
Well, I can't help but think it would be good, except that in my stories, I always have opposing views. In other words, people argue all possible ways of looking at psychohistory and deciding whether it's good or bad. So you can't really tell. I happen to feel sort of on the optimistic side. I think if we can somehow get across some of the problems that face us now, humanity has a glorious future, and that if we could use the tenets of psychohistory to guide ourselves, we might avoid a great many troubles. But on the other hand, it might create troubles. It's impossible to tell in advance.
My guest is Isaac Asimov, the science and science fiction writer, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Isaac Asimov is my guest. You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very well, I'm glad to say. Because they're hard to do.
Had you lost your interest in science fiction during that hiatus?
No, not at all. But I had thought that the field had gotten beyond me. You know, it's a rapidly developing field, and the science fiction that's written today isn't at all like the science fiction I wrote in my time. And I felt that I was just a quaint hangover from a previous generation, and that it would show. And I didn't make any effort to write in the 80s fashion, let us say. They wanted another Foundation book. I wrote it exactly as I wrote my Foundation books in the 1940s. And it seemed to go well. So I continued writing in my way, regardless of any changes that had taken place. And there seemed to be enough people who are willing to read my stuff, written in its way, for it to be reasonably successful. So I'm happy.
What are the changes that have taken place in the science fiction genre that you're referring to?
Well, for one thing, they've gone away from, for the most part, there are always exceptions, but they've moved away from being preoccupied with science and technological advance and moved in the direction of social effects. That's content. And then stylistically, things are much freer now. You can be much more realistic. You can make use of words you weren't allowed to make use of in my day. You could describe actions that you weren't allowed to describe in my day, and so on. And as a matter of fact, it's now terribly passé not to do that sort of thing. And so in my last few books, just as an experiment, I wiped out all vulgarisms whatsoever, even hells and dams, you know. I just didn't use them. I wanted to see if I would get letters telling me that, hey, there isn't a single expletive anywhere in your books. That's not real. That's not the way people speak. I never got a single letter to that effect, not one. Nobody seemed to notice. So I figured, well, what the heck? Why bother sticking in all that stuff when it doesn't come natural to me?
Your new book is a sequel to Fantastic Voyage. You wrote the novelization of the movie. And in the new book, a team of scientists miniaturize themselves to travel to the brain of a Soviet scientist who has many, many secrets that they want to unravel. Why did you want to do a Fantastic Voyage 2?
Well, you see, it's not exactly a sequel. What happened was Fantastic Voyage, the first book, was a movie. And they came to me with a movie script and asked if I would novelize it. And I did, for a small, flat sum, largely because I'd never done anything of the sort. And it took me only 6 weeks to do it. And it was turned out to be a huge success, quite independent of the movie. Usually these movie throwaway things, once the movie's through, they're thrown away. But this one, it's still in print, both in hardcover and in softcover, and still selling more than 20 years after the movie had its play. So, but I never was really happy with it because it hadn't been my own imagination. I took it from the movie. And what's more, I couldn't write any more on the subject because the story belonged to the movie people. And then someone bought the rights to the title. Only the title, not the characters, not the events. Only the title. And they came to me and asked me to write Fantastic Voyage 2. And eventually I agreed. And this time I made use of my own imagination. I told a story of submarines inside the human body as I wanted to tell it. And whether that makes it better or worse, I'll leave it for others to decide. But I was much happier with the second one.
Well, in Fantastic Voyage 2, the destination is the brain. I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty obsessed with the brain over the years. You've written a lot of science books and science essays about the brain. And I think, is it fair to say that that's the organ of the body that interests you most?
Well, in a way, yes. In the first place, that's the way I make my living. I mean, I use my brain such as it is. And in the second place, it is at once the most hopeful and the most dangerous part of the human body. Most hopeful because solutions to problems arise from the human brain, and the most dangerous because the problems themselves also arise from the human brain. It's the thoughts, the ideas, the genius that solve the problems, but it's our tendency towards hatreds and fears and suspicions that create the problems. And we don't know how the brain works. So that naturally makes it all the more interesting.
I think a lot of people live in fear as they get older that the power of their brain is going to diminish with age. Is that something that you've worried about?
No, you can't help but worry about such things. After all, I've depended all my life on a rather remarkable memory. So I don't take notes. I don't keep cross-filed indexes or anything. Everything gets piled into my head and stays there. And I call it up whenever I need it. And I know that as one gets older and older, that the brain, like any other part of the body, gradually deteriorates. And so I keep waiting for my memory to start going. It's a frightening thing. Every time I can't think of a word, I say, oh, there it goes. But so far, it's managing. I am now 67, and I'm still going along full speed. How much longer I can manage, I don't know. But every added day is a day of glory for me.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, what made you turn your head from that video?
I didn't want to see anything probing through my blood vessels to my heart. It just didn't strike me as an aesthetic experience.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. When I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
With that said, are there any breakthroughs or inventions that you really would like to see happen?
Oh, I want to see how. I want to have people find out just how the brain works. And that, to me, is the most important conceivable problem to be solved in the world. And at a lesser scale, I would like to see a space-centered society. I want to see the human range extended. I want to see mining stations on the moon, and huge settlements in orbit around the Earth. I would like to see power plants in orbit and factories. I would like to see as much as possible of Earth's industrial plant moved into space so that we don't foul our own nest with waste products. Of course, people say, well, then we'll just foul space, but space is much larger. And space has an automatic cleaning device called the solar wind, so that things might be better up there. Oddly enough, the pollution of space is not so much the ordinary chemical wastes and all that. It's the fragments of satellites that are beginning to worry people, because they stay in orbit. Billions and countless billions of little particles, sometimes just of paint, which are moving around at 5 miles a second, and which, when they strike, can do damage, even when they're very light. So we're going to have to figure out ways of sweeping up space, for instance.
If there were space colonies in your lifetime, would you dare to travel to them?
No, not me. Not me, but someone has to stay on Earth, and I volunteer.
Isaac Asimov, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. His latest book, Fantastic Voyage 2, is published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with composer Philip Glass. A new recording of his opera Akhenaten has just been released. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with award-winning obituary writer Jim Nicholson. He's turned the obituary page of the Philadelphia Daily News into a place to celebrate the lives of truck drivers, maids, and bartenders. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the new album from soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Robert Altman's television adaptation of Harold Pinter's play The Room. It airs on ABC this Saturday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Congressional negotiators are still trying to come to an agreement on a $600 billion spending bill. Now the sticking point is the fairness doctrine, the rule that says broadcasters must allow airtime for opposing points of view. Republicans, like Silvio Conti of Massachusetts, say the Democrats are being unfair about the fairness rule.
I think this is wrong. I think it's unfair what they're doing to these members of Congress who should be home in this Christmas season with their families and with their children because of their own self-centered position on this issue.
President Reagan is threatening to veto the spending bill if it includes the fairness doctrine. The other issue that had been holding up the budget process, aid to the Contras, has been resolved. The budget now includes $8.1 million of non-lethal aid for the Nicaraguan rebels. More than 1,500 people are still missing today after an overcrowded Philippine ferry boat sank last night. The Manila-bound ferry collided with a small tanker about 110 miles southeast of Manila. It could be the world's worst peacetime shipping disaster. The ferry was only licensed to carry 1,493 passengers, but there were more than 100 others on board who did not buy tickets. 14 oil rig workers were killed today in a helicopter accident in the Gulf of Mexico. One survived and has been taken to the burn unit of a suburban New Orleans hospital. The Coast Guard says weather conditions in the area were very bad. And in Bordeaux, France, a commuter airliner carrying 16 people crashed today as it approached the airport. No one survived the accident. Engineers from NASA and space shuttle contractor Morton Thiokol are still trying to figure out why an important booster rocket didn't go off as scheduled this weekend. The test is considered a prerequisite to a resumption of shuttle flights. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The rocket contains 99% of the design changes made after the explosion of the shuttle Challenger. The changes in the rocket's joints are designed to prevent hot gas leaks like the one that doomed the Challenger. On Saturday, engineers reached T-minus 1 second in a simulated launch countdown when an ignition mechanism malfunctioned. Spokesmen for NASA and Morton Thiokol say this delay is not considered serious and should not affect NASA's plans to resume shuttle flights in June. This test and two more like it exposed the booster to most of the pressures of launch. NASA officials say they won't certify the redesigned booster for flight until these tests are successfully completed. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
South Korean opposition leaders Kim Dae-jung and Kim Young-sam today repeated their charges of ballot fraud in last week's presidential elections, but both also acknowledged that their rivalry helped No Tae-woo win the election. From Seoul, William Horsley reports on the latest charges in a newspaper advertisement.
The landslide victory of the government candidate No Tae-woo in last week's election took most observers completely by surprise. And in an advertisement published in several South Korean newspapers, the opposition Party for Peace and Democracy, led by Kim Dae-jung, declares that it was a clever, carefully planned fraud using 8 different and illegal methods. Almost a million of No Tae-woo's 8 million votes, it says, were ghost votes cast in the names of people who do not exist. Another 500,000 were manipulated votes cast by absentees, mostly soldiers in army camps away from their own electoral districts. Ballot boxes were also switched, the party says, by squads of police outside polling stations or on the way to the counting places. In other cases, the substitution was made after official ballot boxes were smuggled out of polling stations, as is suspected in one much publicized case in Seoul.
William Horsley, I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of a new recording from Steve Lacy. Lacy is the modern pioneer of the soprano saxophone, having played it before John Coltrane sparked widespread interest in the horn. Lacy was born in New York, but in the late 60s he settled in Paris, where he writes music for a variety of ensembles, including a sextet he's led since 1971.
Steve Lacy is the most cosmopolitan of jazz composers. He's inspired by painters' squiggles and poets' economy as much as by music in its varied guises. His instrumental pieces owe a lot to Thelonious Monk's deliberative clunkiness, to nursery rhymes, and the minimalism of boogie-woogie piano. His compositions for voice also smack of European art songs, cabaret music, and composer Harry Parch's Hobo Concerto. Lacy's RCA album Momentum contains his setting of a Herman Melville poem, Art, sung by Irene Abbey. Lacy calls it a recipe for art, yet he tramples Melville's line endings. His contrary melody seems pointedly Japanese. Now I ask you, what other jazz composer alludes to Oriental thought's influence on American transcendentalism? His Catholic tastes, Lacy proudly calls himself a jazz musician and writes mostly for his sextet, in which he and Steve Potts pair up on saxophones and Irene Abbey doubles on violin and cello. Where Lacy's melodies are angular to the point of being obtuse, pianist Bobby Few, bassist Jean-Jacques Avenel, and drummer Oliver Johnson underplay the material, giving it supple swing and blues feeling. Momentum showcases the sextet. Lacy himself, a master of the soprano and the oblique line, keeps a low profile for better and worse. Irene Abbey sings two or three songs, depending on whether you're talking about the CD or the LP, and her mannered academic style is tough to warm up to. The good news is Momentum spotlights Lacy's long-overlooked alter ego, Steve Potts. His throaty sound and pouncing attack on alto and soprano contrast effectively with the leader's wispier style. Here's Steve Potts on The Bath. On LP, Momentum has four tracks. On CD, it has six, including a Dirty Blues from Marvin Gaye. When a CD issue of an album has more music than the LP, the extra stuff is usually tacked on the end like an encore. The difference between Momentum on CD and LP is like the difference between a long club set and a short one. The order of the program, its pace and flow are very different. The jazz industry seemed to cross a great divide in '87. Like it or not, the CD is the new standard. More and more jazz is coming out only on compact disc,
Suddenly, it's not like CDs contain extra music, it's like LPs are missing music. This is good news for the haves and bad news for the have-nots. Independent jazz labels can't afford to make CDs. A lot of folks I know can't afford to buy them. Still, one thing's clear. Due to the CD, the hour-long album is replacing the 40-minute one. How musicians will deal with that format shift is something else. On Lacey's first set conceived for CD, he follows the pattern of almost 40 years ago, when LPs began to replace 78s. As the available time expands, the takes get longer and the players stretch out. The shortest cut on Momentum is 7 minutes, the longest 15. If other musicians follow suit, which does not seem to be happening, the 10 or 20-minute solo of two decades ago may be on its way back.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times magazines. He reviewed Momentum, the new album from Steve Lacy on RCA. Listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Nicholson, a Philadelphia Daily News obituary writer with a cult following. No longer do his readers think of the obit desk as the first stop for an aspiring rookie or a Siberia for a wayward reporter. His obits have been described by one of his editors as folk art. He thinks of his work as oral history. Nicholson's obits celebrate the lives of people who were never famous or wealthy or influential outside of the neighborhood. The people he's written about include a former ice hauler, a trash truck driver, a housewife, and a domestic. Along with his devoted Philadelphia readership, Nicholson has a recent Distinguished Writing Award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors to testify to his unusual achievement. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I've chosen some excerpts of obituaries that you've written that I'd like for you to read for us.
Okay, the first one is Joseph Joe the Goat Dorito. Hardly anyone, including his family, is exactly sure what he did during his 20 years at the Philadelphia Parking Authority. But that was regarded as a side job anyway. His principal occupation was just being Joe the Goat. Trash truck hauler Leon H. Grant. He had rigged a speaker system inside the cab to hear music, and the booties of his latest grandchild usually hung from the visor. A religious man who was an active member of Devereux United Methodist Church, Grant was described as the one who taught his children to pray, and then taught his grandchildren. Lawrence Larry Dimples Mallary, ex-cabbie. Handsome with wavy chestnut hair and a quick smile, Larry Dimples was a sharp dresser and a real good dancer who was a lover boy who never lacked for female friends, said his sister. He was a smooth talker. He had personality, looks, what else?
This last obituary that you read, this is not the kind of guy who you'd usually read about on an obituary page. He did not lead a celebrated life. I don't know if there are any big landmarks in his life. Why did you choose him to write about on your obituary page?
Well, Terry, like most people on my obituary page, he had no so-called credentials to even get there had it been an orthodox obit page. But he did live a life. He lived a good life. Larry was one of the guys you see on the corner. and you wonder where Larry's life goes when he leaves the corner. Larry is that old guy you see in the fast food place having a cigarette and cup of coffee and looking out under a very old furrowed brow at people walking by, and you catch a glance at him and you say, what brought him to this chair in this fast food place or this all-night diner? And what we try to do in about 15 or 20 inches is run his life back in fast reverse and see where he started and what brought him here.
Did you know right away when you started the obit page that you wanted to write obituaries about people from the neighborhoods?
Yes, from the very first. The very first obit, October 18th, 1982, was on a stakeout police officer who had died. And it's been that way ever since. There was never any question.
I think of your obituaries as being a little like eulogies, in that they describe the person from the perspective of people who knew them and loved them and who loved their eccentricities and appreciated them for that. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, they are eulogies. In fact, some priests and ministers will read them from the pulpit at a service. Being in a newspaper, it gives it almost a false sense of authority. You know, the printed word, it must be true, and this is important. So they'll hold the clipping at the service and say, here's what they said in the Daily News about so-and-so. He must be important because it's in the newspaper.
Most feature stories and articles in newspapers just get thrown out after they're read. I bet your obituaries are saved for many years.
Oh, my gosh, Terry, they're almost immortal. The greatest investigative piece I ever wrote when I thought I was really important never survived more than a few weeks in terms of being kept around. But these obituaries, they're laminated, they're put under glass, they're hung on walls, they're in family Bibles. In fact, they're even put into the inside coat pocket of the deceased. And they'll be around long after you and I are gone.
You get people to tell you wonderful things. This is from one of your obituaries. You write, he was an expert driver who could weave a car through heavy traffic in record time while singing a romantic ballad. He knew the words to every mushy song from the 1930s through the 1950s. That's great. I mean, who would tell a reporter that?
Well, they don't tell you this right at first. Initially, people in a phone interview, and most of mine are by phone, will tell you what is proper and right and they think should be on the record. But very, very few people in this world can talk to somebody for more than an hour. And we see this on police interrogations that run on for 3 hours until finally you start getting to the core of who this person was. And after they give their initial four-minute prepared speech on the person, then we get into who this person really was.
Many of us spend considerable time wondering about and worrying about our own deaths. Has being this involved with death, writing about it every day, made you think about death more?
I don't think about it any more than the average person, I suppose. And I don't carry any emotional excess baggage from doing the job, I don't think. But what it has done, it's made me admire the average person for all the things that they do with their lives, the volunteer work that they do. And I do a lot of stories where people are facing death over a period of a year or 2 years, and how they get their affairs in order and the great courage that they have to do this. I guess it has affected me a little bit. I have always been a day-at-a-time person and enjoy what you've got, but it's even more so now.
Your obituary page has become very popular, and I imagine a lot of people pursue you now so that you can write an obituary about their deceased friend or relative. How do you decide who you're actually going to cover?
Generally, I'm not pursued that heavily that I can't handle it yet, but I've been able to write obits on virtually everybody who calls, and it's sufficient. And I get calls from, say, a 14-year-old girl from the ghetto in North Philadelphia who doesn't go through any bureaucracy. She just dials my number and says, I want to talk about my grandmom. And presto, the next day, this girl's grandmom has a 18-inch obit with picture. Now, where else can this happen? It can't happen anywhere. You know, people can't get into newspapers anymore. The guard stops them downstairs, unless you're a crooked politician or a movie star. How are you going to get into a newspaper today?
Have you ever had to say to anybody, I'm sorry, but your mother or your grandmother isn't interesting enough or important enough to get into the paper?
Never, never. Nonsense. There is no uninteresting obits. Only uninteresting questions asked by a reporter.
There's a lot of obituary jokes. I know one or two. Like, I always read the obituaries to see if I'm dead. And people are dying who never died before. Do people tell you a lot of obit jokes?
I am the butt of a lot of obit jokes. myself and the Inquirer obituary writer, we've heard them all. And, you know, they nickname me Dr. Death and all this sort of thing. And so I get back at them sometimes. In the elevator, I'll say to someone, Charlie, do you have a recent picture of yourself? And they'll look at me twice.
I guess, in a way, I hate to bring this up, but you know that now you will be eligible for one of the really large official obituaries because you've made such an important contribution to the city. It's a funny thing to bring up.
Well, I suppose I have not written my own obituary. I like to think that my obituary is already being written in a lot of little obituaries. It's already out there.
Jim Nicholson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jim Nicholson is the obituary writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are coming up?
Well, we're following the debates and events on Capitol Hill, where the entire year's legislation has come down to one big bill, a continuing resolution, which includes the funding for the whole federal government, Contra aid included, and also the Fairness Doctrine. Whether it's good or bad that the budget process should have turned into this one bill a year process, we'll talk about that. Also, a report on West Point women, now that the first group admitted during the 70s has graduated some years ago, have their careers have been what they thought they'd be, that, and also the strikes and violence in the occupied territories, the West Bank and Gaza.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Saturday night, after all the television Christmas pageantry is over, a Harold Pinter play, directed by Robert Altman, will be broadcast on ABC. Both Pinter and Altman are known for producing sometimes enigmatic works. Pinter's plays include The Homecoming, The Birthday Party, and Betrayal. Altman's films include Nashville, MASH, Three Women, and Brewster McCloud. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review of The Room.
I don't mean to be a humbug or anything, but as far as I'm concerned, there are two groups of people who have just as much reason to dread the Christmas season as to enjoy it. One group is made up of post office employees. The other group is made up of TV critics. Every TV production company makes at least one Christmas special, it seems, and they're all hoping to create an instant classic that translates, in terms of annual reruns and royalties, into perpetual wealth. A Charlie Brown Christmas, for example, has been shown every December for 22 years, and the profits are anything but peanuts. As a public service, I'm refusing to review any Christmas specials this week, and that leaves only one special worth discussing. It's director Robert Altman's strange version of Harold Pinter's equally strange one-act play called The Room. This is Altman's second Pinter play for ABC. The first one, shown earlier this year, was The Dumb Waiter. I liked it, but it was bogged down by the miscasting of John Travolta as a British hitman. The Room has a more effective cast. Linda Hunt stars, along with Donald Pleasence, Julian Sands, and Annie Lennox, lead singer for Eurythmics. Linda Hunt plays Rose, a woman whose drab one-room apartment is invaded, temporarily, by a strange young couple who claim to be looking for the landlord. Lennox and Sands play the spooky young couple, and Pleasence may or may not play the landlord, who may or may not be named Mr. Kidd. This conversation between Rose and her unwanted visitors should justify my confusion.
What'd you say the name was?
Hud.
That's it. So you're the wife of the bloke you mentioned then?
No, she isn't. That was Mr. Kidd.
Was it? I thought it was Hud.
No, it was Kidd. Wasn't it, Mrs. Hud?
That's right, the landlord.
No, not the landlord. The other man.
Well, that's his name. He's the landlord.
Who?
Mr. Kidd.
Is he?
I know this is supposed to be art, but to me it's like pantomime with dialogue. I watch and I watch and I have no idea what it's supposed to be about. The scene you just heard reminds me of a bad Abbott and Costello routine performed by people who record those foreign language instruction records. You know, the ones where everyone speaks like this. I don't feel bad about being confused or bored because the characters act the same way. After the strange couple leaves and the strange landlord, or whatever he is, shows up, Rose actually drops her monotone and gets upset by the same things that are bothering me.
What was it all about? Did you see those people? How can this room be going? It's occupied. Did they get hold of you, Mr. Kidd?
Get hold of me? Who?
I told you, two people. They
were
looking for the landlord.
I was getting ready to come and see you as soon as I heard the van go. That's why I come up before, but he hadn't gone yet. I've been waiting for him to go the whole weekend.
Mr. Kidd, what did they mean about this room?
Room?
Later in the play, something happens which breaks all the monotony, and I thought, aha, now it'll start getting interesting. The very next thing that happens, though, is a fade to black, followed by the closing credits. It's almost enough to make you want to see another Christmas special. Santa Claus, I understand. Harold Pinter's The Room is another story altogether. I like symbolism as much as the next guy, but to enjoy The Room, the next guy would have to be Salvador Dali.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Kathleen Tynan. She's written a biography of her late husband, theater critic Kenneth Tynan, whose flamboyant lifestyle diverted attention from his remarkable commentary. He's been called theater's most important critic since George Bernard Shaw. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Charles Brown, the soul singer who first made hits out of songs like Christmas, Baby, Please Come Home, and Merry Christmas, Baby. And book critic John Leonard will review a new collection of essays by novelist Reynolds Price. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants, research assistants from Sue Spolin and Beth Wilcox. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.